Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Today's class is a continuation of yesterday's. Now, if you didn't join yesterday, firstly, you can still go back and see yesterday's episode. Even if you didn't, I think you'll be able to appreciate the things we're going to talk about today, but it can best be apprehended when it's viewed with the background we achieved yesterday. We are in the midst of studying the first of the Shir HaMaalot, Psalm 120. In this extraordinary psalm, King David prophetically projects onto Israel's exilic future. And he stunningly pinpoints the source of our problems. The source of murder and mayhem, the source of persecution and prejudice, the source of suffering, trial, and travail. David HaMelech brilliantly, poetically, prophetically sources it back to lies and libel, to slander, and to the demonization that the Jewish people has suffered time and again. Today, part 3 of Kapitel Kufchav is going to pick up with verse 5, but we'll be going back to verse 4. Just to remind everybody, we'll give you a station identification. The Song of Ascents begins with King David's cry out of distress. And God responds. And David's distress is he seeks to be rescued from proverbial lying lips and deceitful tongues. You must go and watch yesterday's class to understand what that means. There is no profit, there's no gain. It's an empty kind of, really a vacuous pursuit that's fueled by hate, not lust. It's fueled by animosity, not a desire to experience any kind of pleasure. King David metaphorized, bringing to the fore the image of sharp arrows and flaming coals. We talked about this yesterday, and with Hashem's help, I hope to shed more light on those metaphors today. But first, I want to move forward into the next pasuk, the next verse in this chapter of Tehillim, verse 5, which opens with a very unusual word. In fact, it's so unusual that this is the only time in the entirety of Tanakh, the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses, no such word. The Nevi'im, all the prophets, no such word. The Ketuvim, the prophetic scriptural writings, no such word. This is the only time in the 24 books of our Jewish Bible that the word Oyo shows up. Yeah, it sounds like Oyvei, and that's essentially what it means. David HaMelech says, woe is to me, that inasmuch as Oyvei is part of the lexicon of just about every single Jew I know, and if not oive, it's ah, oh, eh, funny noises, you know. lamentful noises. Speaking of discomfort, frustration, it's such a Jewish thing to do. You know, we complain all the time. And funny enough, this word shows up but once, right here. Oya li, woe is to me, alas, says King David. Ki garti meshech, for I have sojourned. Now, meshech sounds like a place, so I'm going to go with in meshech. Shochanti, I have dwelt, im ohle keder, with tents of keder. Where's meshech? And whose tents do keder belong to? Well, this, my friends, is going to be the beginning of a very interesting scriptural journey. We're going to sojourn behind the meaning of these unusual places and metaphors. What is David HaMelech talking about? Let us begin. Oye, woe is to me, oye li, in Rashi's commentary. It's interesting to note that Rashi, Rabbeinu Shlomo Yitzchaki, the great 11th century, really nonpareil biblical commentator, he has a methodology in which he transcribes words, specific words of the scripture, that he intends to comment upon, and then he explains those words. Very interestingly, although Rashi will seem to be shedding some light on the identification of Meshech or perhaps Kedar, that's not the word he chooses to elaborate on. He chooses to elaborate on the word Oye Li, woe is to me, alas. This is a lamentful cry from the psalmist. And so Rashi begins to explain, this is not David HaMelech's personal woes. This is not his personal cry, although David does plenty of that. In this verse, King David speaks in the voice of a nation. In Rashi's words, Omra Knesset Yisrael, the congregation, the proverbial gathering called Israel. So this is a nation speaking. The nation of Israel says, Oye li, woe is to me. And although it says, Oye li, which is singular, it can and should be understood not as one person, but as a nation speaking as a single unit. In other words, it doesn't say, Oye lanu, woe is to us. It says, Oye li, but that's poetic license when it's Knesset Yisrael, the proverbial congregation of Israel, speaking as if it were in first person, in the singular tense. Oye li, Knesset Yisrael says, Kvar lakiti begaluyot rabim. I have already suffered many exiles. Obviously, David HaMelech is not talking about himself. Clearly, he's not speaking about the Jewish people in his time. For at that moment in history, the Jewish people had endured but a single galut. It's called Galut Mitzrayim. That was the Egyptian exile. According to a particular methodology, we can begin to count those exilic sojourns from the birth of Isaac, but it's still part of Galut Mitzrayim, all comprising the 400 years of exilic dispersion and displacement that Abraham was told by Hashem would happen to his progeny. So now Rashi is telling us that David HaMelech is projecting into the future. And he says, Oye li. The congregation of Israel says, woe is unto me. I have already endured many exiles. At what point is the congregation of Israel making this declaration? When are the many exiles? So Rashi says something very interesting. Hare, after all, garti meshech. I have lived meshech. He doesn't tell you who Meshech is. He says, I've lived Meshech. What does it mean, living Meshech? He says, I've lived Meshech in Bnei Yefet, b'malchut Poras, with the children, the offspring of Yefet. That's one of the sons of Noah, Shem, Chom, and Yefet. So I've lived with the children of Yefet under the rule or dominion, the Malchus of Paras, Persia, Yavon of Greece, Umeshech. And we're back to Meshech, but we don't really know who that is. Rabbeinu Yosef Chiyun, a great Rishon from the 15th century, really even earlier, 14th century, he suggests that we would do wise to look at Genesis 10. In the beginning of Chumash Bereishis, in the beginning of the book of Genesis, in the second, near the end of the second Torah portion, which is called Noach, in what today comprises the opening of the 10th chapter, we read, Ve'ela toldot b'nei Noach, these are the offspring of the generations of the children of Noach. There's Shem, there's Chom, and there is Yofet. And the Torah says, Vayivoldu lahem bonim achar amabul, each begat children or built a family after the great flood. Verse 2 begins by talking about B'nai Yefet. Who are B'nai Yefet? So the Torah says, Gomer, Umagog, Umadai, V'yavon, V'tuval, Umeshech, V'siras. So you probably recognize the name Modai. That's the empire that dominated the world stage at the time when the Babylonian Empire collapsed. But really it's called Malchus Paras Umodai, because the seat of government swiftly shifted into Persia. Think the story of Purim. There's Darius the Median, Daryavash HaModi, and then there's Darius II, or Daryavash HaParsi, who we believe to be the son of Esther HaMalka and Achashverosh. You heard of Yavon, Rashi just mentioned him. Greece is the empire built by Alexander the Great of Macedonia. Gomer, not familiar. Magog, he's a name that shows up in end of day prophecies. Tuval, we don't have clarity as to who that is. Meshech is mentioned here, but we're still trying to figure out who Meshech is. And the last name, which is Siros, Rashi says, Zoporas. This is Persia. So the commentaries on Rashi, they say, oh, why did Rashi choose to explain the name Siros, which is from the Bereishis Rabbah, from the Midrash? Why didn't he talk about Gog, Gomer, Tuval, Meshach? I mean, like, if you're either going to explain all the names and give us names we're more familiar with, or not. So Rabbeinu Leo Mizrahi, who is one of the foremost commentators on Rashi, he explains that the reason that Rashi felt compelled to give you the interpretive or alter name of Tiras, which is Paras, which is Persia, is because since Paras is very close to Modai, they border on each other, Media and Persia bordered on each other, why did he mention Media and not mention Persia? Both of these will share the world stage together. So therefore, Rashi feels compelled to tell you that they were mentioned. And after all, Persia was more dominant than Media was. True, he says. However, it's easy to understand that Tiras is a reference to Persia for whatever reason, and therefore Media and Persia are mentioned. All right, so let's think this through now a little bit. So Rashi's telling us that Oyeli, this collective groan, this sigh, this woe unto me, uttered by a displaced and exiled nation of Israel, is referring to Meshech, which is Rashi says, Meshech im bnei Yefet. Meshech is together with the children of Yefet. Now, when you read Rashi after seeing Rabbeinu Yosef Chiyun, now it makes sense. So you say, Meshech is together with bnei Yefet, b'malchut poras v'yovan u'meshech. But we never hear about Malchus Meshech. We hear about Yovan. We hear about Poras. Who is Meshech? And oddly enough, the term Meshech, or the name Meshech, is used in Psalm 120, whereas the names Modai and Poras are not. So this is, seems very perplexing on the surface. When we take a look at the Ibn Ezra, and usually transcribes the word Oya, whoa. And he says, Yosef ben Gurion, better known as Josephus Flavius, the famous historian. He said that Meshech is Anche Tuscano, the people of Tuscany. The people of Tuscany are in the region of the place we call Rome. So that means, Oya li kigarti, according to what the Ibn Ezra is saying, quoting Josephus, that garti meshech means I have sojourned under the tutelage of Meshech, which is Rome, Tuscany. So I think that this is how we're going to understand this. And this is just my suggestion. I don't know if this is accurate. The Gemara in Masechet Avodah Zarah. The Gemara is on page 10, I believe. The Gemara there talks about the powers to be during the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. Why is that of importance? Well, I mean, on a literal level, the Gemara there is talking about the way we identify dates and time, who we kind of tell time by. Like, for example, the Gregorian calendar essentially is a calendar that's used to document the rise of Christendom. That's really what it is. It's supposedly before the people, the figure or the individual that Christendom worships, that's BC, and then there's AD, where they begin to count from after death. We prefer to use the terminology common era. We don't want to get involved in a religious kind of ideology. To us, this is what they call the secular dates, or the common era as it's known today. What was the common era, though, in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash? So the Gemara that talks about the rise of Greece and Western culture, or Western civilization, which is all based on a Greek philosophy. And the Gemara identifies, as we count time, from the years of Alexander of Macedonia. Anyway, so the Gemara, it's not entirely on Daf Yud. There's also some mention of Gemara two pages earlier and a commentary of Tosfos Siddur, but sewing this all together, here's what we basically get. The time of the second Beit HaMikdash, when the Jewish people returned to Zion, so Galut, the exile that was brought about through Nebuchadnezzar, through Babel, is essentially over now. The miracle of Purim has happened. The Jewish people's star has risen again. We're a free people. We're allowed to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash and Yerushalayim, which is actually interchangeable. So for the first 36 years of the second Beit HaMikdash, we were under the dominion of the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire is called Malchus Poras. Then, Alexander of Macedonia, at the tender age of 16, assembles one of the most incredible fighting forces the world has ever seen, and he begins a campaign to conquer Eurasia and most of Africa successfully. He becomes the new world superpower, the new dominant force in the world. Alexander doesn't live very long. 20 years later, he's dead at the age of 36. The empire he built fractures, There's the northern part, or Assyrian Empire, which is called, under the monarchs called the Seleucids or Seleucids. And then there's the Ptolemaic part of the empire, which is North Africa. So they kind of break with lower part of Asia and Africa, and then Eurasia is under the dominion, or Asia Minor, and Europe is under the dominion of the Seleucids. Where's Israel? So Alexander conquered Israel, and Israel falls under the Assyrian part of Alexander's Greek Empire. And although Alexander was somewhat favorably disposed towards the Jews and allowed the Beit HaMikdash to flourish and Jewish life to continue to develop and unfold, the winds of assimilation had ravaged the landscape of Jewish life in the land of Israel. And subsequent to this, terrible persecution begins to unfold. The entirety of Greek dominion over the land of Israel lasts, the Gemara says, for 180 years. At the end of 180 years, the Greek Empire is miraculously defeated by a small band of pious Jews. You probably heard of them. You may know of their fighting force, which was nicknamed Maccabees, or the family of Kohanim, who led this fighting force, known as Hashmonaim, which was a fancy name for Kohanim in the time of the second Beit HaMikdash. For a period of 24 years, the Hashmonaim ruled the land of Israel independently. It didn't last long, though. At the very same time, Rome crushes the Greek Empire, both the north and the south arenas. And the only country that Rome doesn't actually dominate during that small period is Israel. And then two brothers have a fight, Jonathan Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. And Jonathan Hyrcanus opens the door to get some help from the Romans, who are too eager to get their foot in the door. And that's the beginning of the end. Malchut Hashmonai sinks. Herod, who's not even halachically Jewish, builds an extension of that monarchy, and thus begins the Herodian period. And that period lasts, during the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, for the last 180 years. Now, we know that the second Beit HaMikdash stood for 420 years. So let's do the math. 180, that's the Greek period. 180 is the Roman period. That gives us 360. We're still missing 60 years because the Beis HaMikdash stood for 420 years. 36 years and 24 years completes the picture, giving us a total of 420 years. And this, my dear friends, is the point. At least that's the way I would like to humbly submit. Rashi explains this. After the first Galut, we were supposed to return to Israel, leaving Galut behind. It never happened. Never happened. We left the Babylonian Galut. We miraculously were saved by Hashem for Purim, and the Galut just continued to linger on. We were in Israel. We had the second Beit HaMikdash, but it's a Galut Beit HaMikdash. We never had real self-determination, except for a tiny window of 24 years that was filled with infighting and the minutiae of personal politics, and perhaps most egregiously, a lack of will on behalf of the descendants of the righteous, pious Kohanim who defeated the Greeks to restore the Davidic dynasty and to bring Malchus David back to the seat of governance. So, woe is to me. David HaMelech laments the fact that even when we left Golos, the Golos didn't leave us. He said, Knesset Yisrael, the house of Israel, the congregation of Israel says, woe is to me. Ki garti meshech, because I kept living with meshech. So who's meshech? So meshech is considered to be in the same genre of Modai, Yavon, Tuval, and Meshech. But really, who is Meshech? According to Ibn Ezra, Meshech, and Rashi doesn't explain this in Genesis 10, Meshech is actually referring to Tuscany or to Rome. In other words, that even after we left Galut behind, we remained in Galut. And why then do we use the name Meshech? So firstly, Meshech is where it ends up. We're under the dominion of Tuscany, or Meshech or Rome, and we continue to be in Galut Roma. This is Galut Edom. The Galut, the present Galut, is called the Roman exile, up until this very day. So actually, the lion's share of the time, or that which dominated during the waning 18 decades of the second Beis HaMikdash, the last 18 decades, and going forward was Meshech. So it makes sense to say, Garti Meshech. But the Radak says something else. Radak adds that the word Meshech comes from the terminology Nimshecha Galut. Me'od, the Galut just lingered. It just wouldn't leave us. We just kept suffering from Galut. We couldn't seem to shake ourselves of exile. We couldn't experience real self-determination, ever dominated by other world powers. Oh, by the way, does Israel really have free reign today? Do we, the Jewish people, really have true and full self-determination? Or are we being buffeted and puppeted around by countries like the United States, entities like the European Union, and endlessly demonized by the United Nations? Do we really have freedom and self-determination? Do any of the world's countries question and condemn the fact that we in Canada are living on native people's lands? Oh yes, now I know we have woke culture. So for the last couple of years, whenever I attend an event with York Regional Police, they'll begin by announcing, we acknowledge the native lands we live upon. And the pipe and bands are Scottish, and it's the Queen's English. We're the Aboriginals. We're the original. Pay lip service. Is that can be condemned ever? Anybody ever talk about that? Does the world feel it has the right to lecture our own country, right here in Canada, about how Aboriginals are treated? Nary a sound. But the world has a lot to say about Israel. As I mentioned yesterday, a figment, 0.1% of deaths attributed to a war are happening in Israel. But 99%, and that's not an exaggeration, of the world's condemnation is directed against Israel. Countries that epitomize the abuse of human rights like China, North Korea, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Syria, receive condemnation on the level of probably a ratio of 1 to 100. If you collect all the condemnations by the supposed body of peace at the UN, that's leveled against Israel. It was never any different. Throughout the time that we lived in Israel, we were constantly being maligned, lied about, lied to, and libeled. Libel after libel was leveled against the Jewish people. Why did Darius I issue permission to have the Beit HaMikdash rebuilt only to rescind it? Because we were libeled. He was told that if the Beit HaMikdash would be built, the Jewish people would rebel and declare war on media. It's not true. The Jewish people's wars have always been wars of defense. The last time we went on an offensive was during the days of King David. Time and again, we continued to suffer from this lingering ailment of exile. So David HaMelech says, Oyali! Oyali! He speaks on behalf of the Jewish people. So we're going to go into Golas, but then Golas doesn't end. It sticks with us throughout the period of the second Beis HaMikdash and beyond. Let's go back to the Rashi now. Armed with the information we have from Masechet Avodah Zarah and what Rabbeinu Yosef Chiyun tells us to take a look in Genesis 10. Knesset Yisrael says, Kfar lakisi begolius rabim. So the galut is over, and then the galut just changes colors. We can live in Israel and be in galut because we're not really the masters of our own destiny. Haregarti meshech. And Meshech, Radak tells us, means Nimshecha galusi miod. This doesn't end. It's unending. It's unending. I seem to be endlessly Garti Meshech, which Garti Meshech is Im B'nei Yefet, the children of Yefet. Who are the children of Yefet? Malchus Poras. That's the beginning of the second Beit HaMikdash. Yavon, continuation of the second Beit HaMikdash. A short blip in which there's the possibility of real self-determination of the Jewish people really being able to bring back the Davidic monarchy, David HaMelech's family, but doesn't happen. Umeshech, as Ibn Ezra tells us, Tuscany, straight into Rome. And that's the case until today. So that's the meaning of Ki Garti Meshech. And here's something else really interesting. When our father Jacob returns from his 22-year stint with Laban, he says, Im lovan garti. That's the first time the word garti shows up. And the word garti, he says, is linked to the term ger, a stranger. My friends, you can be a stranger in your own home if you don't have the keys. It's a sojourn. It wasn't even an exile. It's just an endless journey. The scenery changes, but we're not going anywhere. This is a Garti Meshech. This is an extended period, a lingering period of sojourning. It doesn't say the word exile. It says sojourning. B'nei Yefes, Paros, Yavan, U'Meshech. So I would like to humbly suggest to you that Rashi's commentary, Rashi's point here is the entire period of the second Beit HaMikdash essentially is exilic. We were strangers at home. And then Shochanti, then we dwelt in Ohole Kedar, in tents of Kedar. Rashi doesn't talk about that at all. He doesn't mention anything about Kedar. He only explains the words Oyoli. And he explains the meaning of Kigarti Meshech. Shochanti im Ohole Kedar, Rashi omits entirely. Which is actually really interesting. Ibn Ezra says, Ohole Kedar, this refers to Ha'erev. Ha'erev is Arabia. Yisrael mefuzarim b'meshech ve'im Ohole Kedar. So the Jewish people end up dispersed amongst the Arab nations and the Meshech nations. Think Rome. Think the religion that bases itself on Rome. Think Holy Roman Empire. Western civilization has for centuries, for millennia, been under the dominion of Christendom. We, the Jewish people, have suffered exile in two colors, the colors of Arabia or Islam as it evolved, and the colors of Christendom. Tragically, in both circumstances, we were ever persecuted and libeled. And so often, the lies The libel, the demonization led to attacks and murder. In both of these very, very different kinds of social circles, of religious system, and of geographies. It wasn't always different geography. We, the Jewish people, were persecuted in Spain almost centuries on end. First persecuted by the fanatical Almohads, who dominated most of Spain, think Maimonides. And then, when Christendom wrests control of Spain, the Spanish Inquisition. Jewish people had been living in Sfarad, in Spain. The vast majority of Jewish people lived in Spain for centuries. Don, which is like Lord, Yitzhak Abarbanel, who was the finance minister of Portugal, had a family lineage that went back to the house of David HaMelech. He maintains that his family has been living in that part of the world since the time of the first Beis HaMikdash to avoid persecution. So according to the words of the Ibn Ezra, this pasuk really sums up galut. Galut for the Jewish people. We have been dispersed or despoiled either by Christendom or Islam. Those are two tragic facts. May not be politically correct, but facts are stubborn things. There is no record of persecution from other faith systems, like, for example, the Hindus. In fact, India has no record of anti-Semitism whatsoever. The only record of anti-Semitism was during periods of Islamic dominance. Tragic fact. The two major, if you will, orbits, which today are vying for control of the world, what they call the West and the East, represented by these two faith systems. This is what David HaMelech, what King David's talking about. Oyeli, woe is to me, for we have suffered so terribly under both. Today in the radio, I was asked if I think that the next generation is getting proper Holocaust education. I don't think so. Why? I was asked. Why? I said, because that's the nature of time. The further you are, the more distant it becomes. I said, do you know anything about the Inquisition? She said, well, something. Oh, well, it was nothing like the Holocaust. Really? 99 years of persecution? Hundreds of thousands killed? Displaced? World Jewry used to be primarily centered in the Iberian Peninsula. They never recovered. Sephardic Jewry was decimated. Of course, the problem is when we become hyper-focused on one period in Jewish history and ignore other periods and other times of persecution. Is it a numbers game? If only 1 million Jews were killed, then it's not really noteworthy, but 6 million is noteworthy? These are not politically correct things to say, I understand. But they are factual things. David HaMelech says, this has been an endless sojourn of exile. What does this have to do with you and me, eh? Well, it actually has a lot to do with us. Because firstly, it gives us a sense of perspective. And we are going to go back to those sharp arrows and those flaming coals. David HaMelech does give us some direction of how we are to deal with anti-Semitism, and that's not a pleasant or fun thing to talk about. But we're also going to learn how to take this very personally today, not just talk about history. Not just lecture everybody else, but rather, as we discussed yesterday, to point many more fingers at ourselves. So in summation, in the way Rashi sees this verse as augmented by Ibn Ezra, we are encapsulating the story of Jewish exile, the story of Jewish persecution, the story of Jewish suffering, not for 2,000 years, but actually for 2,500 years, almost 26 centuries to be exact. The Radak goes on to say something very interesting. He says, after speaking about Meshech, and Radak sees Meshech not as a place, he doesn't identify it with children of Yavan, he sees Meshech as the word Nimshach, lingering, continuing on. He says, the only place or nation we speak of here is Ole Kedar, the tents of Kedar. Radak says, he mentions the Galut amongst Ishmael. Now, what Radak is alluding to is the fact that later on in Genesis 25, verse 13, we read, Ve'elu shmot b'nei Ishmael. These are the generations, the names of the children of Ishmael. Now, it's interesting to note that in Genesis 10, the commentary is like, for example, the great Syrian sage, Rabbi Shmuel Mesanot, he says that these are not actually the names of the children, but rather the nations that came forth. But in Genesis 25, it definitely is the names, or the families. And he says, what are the families? Bechor Yishmael, the eldest, Ishmael's firstborn was Nevoyot. And then, Vekedor. And he says, Adbael Umivsam. One of four children, the name Kedar. Says Radak, that this, he mentions the specific nomadic wanderings of the Jewish people in exile under the thumb of Ishmael, which for the last 13 centuries has become identified with a faith system called Islam. He doesn't mention the Edomite domination, which is very strange because we call this Galut Edom. It was the Romans who destroyed the second base of Megiddo. That's the ancestors, if you will, or the origin of what later evolves into Christendom. And Radak says that's because, at least in Radak's days, Rabbi Dino David Kimchi was a Sephardic Jew, he says, Rov Galut Yisrael Beini Ishmaelim, most of Jewish exile, and he was right, of course, in his time. In the 14th century, most of the Jewish people were not living under Christian domination in Europe. Most of them were living in the Sephardic lands, as in Spain and Portugal, in that area of the world, in the Mediterranean. And so Radak says, that's why the notion of Kedar is mentioned. But after all, Kedar is one of four. So he says, V'zochar Kedar, he mentions Kedar, not Yishmael, because the families of Kedar, they had maintained a purebred lineage to Yishmael. And he says, they are Rosh HaMalchut. In every country, the ruling class was the families that traced their lineage back to Kedar or to Yishmael. It's interesting that there's a lot of tumult going on right now in Jordan. And Jordan, of course, is a country that has an enormous population of Arabs whose culture, language, convention are not any different than the Arabs who call themselves Palestinian living in Israel. In fact, 92% of Jordan is made up of exactly the same families. The same genetics, the same faith system, the same foods, everything is identical. And they're dominated by a family whose extended family comprises less than 8% of the country. They're called the Hashemites. It's called the Hashemite Kingdom. The Hashemites maintain that they have a direct lineage to Muhammad. And Rambam says Muhammad fashioned himself as the Ishmaelite, which may well be that he was directly from the family of Kedar. So if Muhammad was in the family of Kedar, that would be a prime example of the ruling class in the Arab world being Kedarite or from Ishmael. Incidentally, the Ibn Ezra, in his commentary in Genesis with the story of Yaakov and Esav, maintains that most residents of the Middle East are not Ishmaelite. He says they're actually Esavite or Edomite. He says there's a very, very small amount of actual Ishmaelites. But as Radak says here, it seems that they are the ruling class, the ones calling the shots or making the decisions. And then he says something very interesting. So this is all about Kedar. Meshech isn't the name of a people or a place at all. Then Radak goes on a limb and he says, V'yesh mefarshim, there are those who maintain that Meshech is identical with Kedar. So you read this verse as, Oyeli, woe is to me. According to Radak, we're speaking about post-Beit HaMikdash exile. And he says, Garti Meshech, Shachanti, Mo'ole Kedar, it's actually the same. Meshech is Kedar. Why is Meshech Kedar? Ah, Lefi Shehem Moshe Keshes, because they would draw back the bow. And this is directly connected to Ishmael, because Ishmael is the one who is spoken of in the Torah as drawing back the bow. We read that earlier. When Ishmael leaves the house of Avram Avinu, it says, Vayehi Roive Kashos. He becomes an expert archer. He's Moshech. He draws the bow. In other words, it's all Ishmaelite. That's how Radak sees it. And in Radak's world, it was primarily dominated by Ishmael. Ibn Ezra, who lives in Spain, and Rashi, who lives in France, see a clear mention here to both Rome as well as Mecca. They see both Christendom and the orbit of Islam as being the two, so to speak, arenas of the Jewish exile, with Jewish people dividing along those very same fault lines, as we say in our terminology, Ashkenazic Jews and Sephardic Jews. And this leads us into a very interesting place now. So what does that have to do with the slander and the libel? Well, I mean, verse 5 follows verse 4. And verse 4 follows 3, and 3 follows 2. So it is all about libel. It is all about the demonization and the lies being told about us. That's what leads in this direction. However, the great 15th century Rabbeinu Vidal HaTzofarti, he says, the fact that the name Meshech is identical with the notion of drawing back the bow should not be lost on us. Don't you realize that one verse earlier, David HaMelech spoke of the harm of Lashon Hara, of slander, of libel, of lies, of gossip, as arrows, sharp arrows? Says Rabbeinu Vidal, Ki garti im hamoishchim bekeshes. Garti im meshech doesn't just mean a lingering exile. Garti im meshech means I lived amongst those who would endlessly send those arrows. This, my dear friends, has been the characterization of Galut from the beginning. It never starts with murder. It never begins with overt persecution. It begins with accusation of disloyalty. It begins with accusation of killing the God. It begins with accusation of undermining national security. It begins with caricature. It begins with libel, blood libel, well libel. We never poisoned anybody's wells. We never used anybody's blood and matzah. Both are ridiculous. Entirely outlandish. But as the arch evil demon Joseph Goebbels, Yimach Shemo, so correctly intoned, at least when it comes to the Jewish people, if you say a lie again and again, eventually it will be believed. I don't know if that's true entirely. I do know it's true when it comes to us. So the Vidal says, that's the problem. That's what David HaMelech is bemoaning. He says, I have endlessly sojourned, not just in a place that wasn't mine. Exile means you're not at home. He said, we have endlessly exiled amongst those who targeted us for libel, who told lies about us, who framed us, who libeled us time and again. And that has had the most devastating consequences. And therefore, he says, I have lived im sone shalom with those who hate peace, which is going to be the next verse we talk about. Behiyot begalut vegerut. Being in a state of exile and in a state of being looked at as the outsider, the stranger, not like us. Doesn't this sound familiar? Isn't this the kind of thing you hear the canards of the anti-Semites from the right to the left? The hatred that's tragically sometimes still preached in pulpits at churches and tragically so often in mosques. Tragically. Outlandish, ridiculous lies and libel. And that has become the source of our suffering and misfortune. Rabbeinu Yitzchak Arama, better known for his famous work called Akedat Yitzchak. In his commentary on Tillim, which is called Meir Tehilot, he says, earlier we spoke about individuals who engage in slander, in gossip, in libel, in demonizations. He says, now David HaMelech talks about entire nations, and they are the nations of Meshech and Kedar. He says, Datot Kuloshkorim, faith systems that propagated entire lies. Entire lies about the Jewish people. From Christian anti-Semites who accused us of killing Jesus and as such set out to kill us. From Muslim anti-Semites who accused us of abandoning Muhammad and trying to kill him. All lies. These lies have been used to persecute the Jewish people time and again. And I say this with great sadness. We bear no ill will or animosity to anybody. It cheers me when I see people have faith in God. But when fascism is infused with fervor that comes only from faith, then we have a noxious and toxic kind of antisemitism that has damaged and destroyed our people in ways unimaginable. And that, said the Akedas Yitzchok, is the meaning, Kigarti Imohem. For I have lived or been a sojourner, stranger with them. I would venture to say that the Baal Akedas Yitzchok, Rabbeinu Yitzchak Arama, is probably following along the lines of what Rashi and Ibn Ezra told us. This is the story of our Galut. And it all begins with words. The historic depiction of words of slander as sharp arrows, unfortunately, takes us back to our own infighting. The first time sharp arrows are mentioned in poetic prose alluding to words that can kill, are found in the words uttered by Yaakov Avinu, Father Jacob, to his own children on his deathbed. In the end of the book of Genesis, in the 49th chapter, we hear of Yaakov Avinu, Father Jacob, speaking about his son, Yosef, the victim of demonization, the victim of libel, of lies, the victim of Lashon Hara. And what words does he use? Father Jacob says, Vayistemuhu ba'alei chitzim. The masters of chitzim, they hated him. They nursed animosity towards him. So the Medrash Rabbah says in chapter 98, Eilu ba'alei mechitzosei. These are his own brothers, the ones who lived together with him. Shehishlichu alav dvarim koshim, who hurled harsh, painful things, kechetz, like an arrow. And here the Medrash cross-references the gossip-monging, the slandering, the lies and the libels that have been directed against the Jewish people, chitzei giber shenunim, the arrows of the mighty, the sharp arrows of the mighty spoken of in Psalm 120. In other words, my dear friends, the origin of all this comes from within. It's tragic. The Medrash says, Umar ol moshlam b'chetz. I understand you want to use the term of weaponry, that words can be weaponized. Weapons that can inflict tremendous harm and damage, pain and suffering. But why an arrow? Mikol Kli Zayin, from all other different weapons, why the arrow specifically? As the Eitz Yosef explains, Laham shel lashon hara, to metaphorize about gossip in the terms of an arrow, sharp arrows in the hands of a mighty archer. Says the Medrash, Elakol Kli Zayin Makin Bimkoimon. All weapons, at least weapons used in antiquity, from the cudgel to the saber, from the dagger to the machete, they all inflict damage in their immediate, so to speak, orbit, within reach. V'zeh, but the arrow, the missile, the bullet, Makeh Mirochik, it strikes from afar. Kachu Lashon Hara, so it is with this notion of lies and libel. The Omar Beroimi, something is said in Rome, or Kotil Besuria. And deadly effect happens all the way in Assyria. Some maintain that these were the writers we spoke of yesterday from the Medrash Tehillim, members of the Senate in Rome, who demonized the Jewish people, leveled all kinds of accusatory statements against them, and it translates in real time into terror in the streets. Every single time the state of Israel is demonized in world capitals, you can tragically see effects on the street in acts of terror, when they feel empowered to attack and to delegitimize the Jewish state. These are not theories. This is not my opinion. These are tragic facts. And it's never been different. And it's not just arrows. It's not just arrows, because David HaMelech, after calling it arrows, King David said, they are chitzei gimer shenunim im gachli resomim, with those coals, the coals we spoke of yesterday, of juniper or broom. Those coals, says the Medrash, afal pi shikofo mibachutz, uniquely these coals, even when they go ashen cold on the outside, adayin hu boyer bifnim, there's still a fire burning within. And so it is also mi shemekabel lashon hara, the one who accepts the gossip, the one who speaks the gossip, the one who engages in the slander, the lies, and the libel, is like the archer shooting arrows into a crowd. The crowd receives those missiles. They receive all of that demonization. And afal pi sha'ata hoylechu mefaisei, even though you have what they call today hasbara, and you explain why it's wrong, why it's inappropriate, and why it's not really balanced. V'hu mispayes. The person who seems to have received this ill report has said, oh, thank you for explaining things to me. Adayin hu boyer mibifnim. Facts don't matter. What matters is bias. There's an incredible study that was conducted in three universities, no less. If my memory doesn't fail me, it was called the Barrett study, but I'm not sure about that. I didn't believe it myself. I actually had to Google this. Three different universities conducted virtually the same study with the same stunning and terrifying results. People were fed fake facts. And after those facts developed into an attitude or an opinion, then they were told or shown how the information that they were given was inaccurate. It didn't change their mind. Because once people's minds are made up, it doesn't make a difference what you say. That's the story of our people, my friends. We have been endlessly demonized. And so the people who have received and accepted this demonization, the people who now have this hatred that courses in their veins, you tell them a story and you explain to them and you give them a narrative. And you think that the anti-Semitism is gone. But in the last couple of years, we found out that even though the coals of hatred went cold on the outside, they continue to simmer beneath the surface. How current? How telling? How today is this? This is David HaMelech over 3,000 years ago. This is the Medrash, talking about the words of Yaakov. The Medrash goes on to say there was a story of Rotem, this Rotem wood, from which coals were made. And 18 months later, beneath the surface, they were still glowing. I don't know if this is to be taken literally or if this is metaphoric. The point, though, is well made. As the Medrash Tilim tells us, and we spoke about this yesterday, Medrash Tilim says that, tells a story, a maisa, of people who came and built themselves a fire and baked bread and returned to the same juniper tree 12 months later. And they found the ashes, the remnants of where they had cooked their dinner a year ago. And then when they walked on that spot, the feet were burnt because beneath the surface, the fire continued to rage. And that is the mashal. That is the metaphor, the parable of the lashon hara that is kigach l'resamim, like Rotem coals. And this is the evil that actually causes murder and mayhem, says the Medrash. Haresha hazeh hoireg bnei odom. This libel kills. People like to use the terminology hate speech. David HaMelech doesn't use that terminology. He says false characterization, demonization, libel, lies, deceit propagated against Jewish people has tragically had deadly consequences. And he says, wish we suffered, says the Medrash, more than anything else during the Roman period of persecution. The Medrash likens the libels and the deceit that was spread about the Jewish people throughout the Roman Empire as arrows shot into a crowd with deadly results. But they're impossible to trace. Nobody knew who was responsible for the anti-Semitism, the hate, and the murder. But my friends, it all began on the inside. It all began with our own infighting. I'm not giving anti-Semites a pass. But there is a connection between the galut we suffer and our own foolish politics, the hatreds and animosities amongst our own people today. They're not disparate. They're not mutually exclusive. If we continue to study this chapter of Tehillim, if we continue to look into the meaning of these very words, you find direct reference to that. Consider this. There is a Zoharic statement that says that when somebody speaks words of Lashon Hara, you and me, Hasatan lekeach kol ha-mitzvah she'asa la'atzmei, the satanic forces harvest all the merit, the accrued positive energy of your mitzvahs. And that's hinted at in the words, says the Darash Moshe, Oya li ki garti, woe is to me. Garti, which means I have sojourned, also is the same Hebrew letters that spell 613 or Taryag, as our sages comment on the very words garti with Yaakov Avinu. Taryag mitzvah shamarti, he said, garti. He told Esau, he sent a message, garti, I have lived a sojourn with Laban. Garti was a play on words. He said to him, I am still the same pious, observant Jew. I have not lost my values. So garti is connected to taryag. Tof resh yud gimel spells 613, tof is 400, resh is 200, that's 600. Yud gimel is 13. Says the Darash Moshe, kol ha-mitzvahs nitnu le-meshech. The mitzvahs are given to meshech. Oye, kigarti, the verse, the pasuk says, kigarti, meshech. Whoa, my mitzvahs went to meshech. Who's meshech? Meshech is the gematria of Satan. Satan is a euphemism, a code name for dark, evil energy, the spiritual source of our misfortunes. The word Satan has the numeric equivalent of 359. Meshech is 360. But oftentimes there's a mechanism called Im HaKolel, which means that the word itself stands for one. So Satan, Im HaKolel, is 360, as is the word Meshech. Oyeli, woe is to me. So here David HaMelech says, let's not just talk about the anti-Semitism out there, and we talked about that yesterday. The response has to be to call out the lies. The response has to be to state the facts and ask, what are you lying for? If you want to help innocent people, how does characterization, demonization, libel, deceit, how does that feed into your seeming, supposed desire to do good? Why do you have to lie? Why do you have to mischaracterize? Why? What's the point? You claim to seek truth? You claim to seek justice? You claim to seek peace? Why the lies? That should be our response. But my dear friends, as members of Am Yisrael, we must also look inward. I'm not making excuses for anti-Semites, chas v'shalom. Anti-Semitism has to be faced down. But at the same time, we, Am Yisrael, whenever we see misfortune, difficulty, trials and travails, we are also told in our Holy Torah to look inward, not because we are at fault per se, but when a ben or bat Yisrael, when a member of our nation lives as Hashem wants him to live, we become a conduit for Hashem's blessing. And chas v'shalom, heaven forfend, our misconduct can oftentimes serve as a blockage, as a something that stops our own blessings, us realizing our own potential. Remember, this is a verse that speaks about the awful impact of gossip, of lies and deceit about others. The Zohar says you lose all of your mitzvot. Wow, I mean, if that's not going to inspire you to be more careful about the way you use your words, if that doesn't make you realize the power of our tongue, I don't know, it will. The Darash Moshe says this medrash is alluded to in Psalm 120. Oyeli kigarti, for my taryag meshech goes to Satan. And when it goes to Satan, we end up in galus. This very same idea is actually echoed by the Chida. The Chida wrote two compilations on Tehillim. The first is called Yosef Tehillos. His name is Yosef. The second is called Chaimis Anoch. In Chaimis Anoch, the Chida says that he cites the Sefer Eretz HaChaim. He says, Medaber Loshen Hara, a person who speaks gossip and slander, Ma'abed Zechuyotav. He loses his accrued merits. And that's the meaning of the verse prior. In verse 3 it says, Mayitin Lecha, what are all the lies doing for you? You're not profiting, you're not gaining from the gossip, you are losing. Umay Yosef Lach, what's being added to you? Hachatois Sha'osa, Oisis Shedibarta Allah Lashon Hara, you spoke about somebody else's imperfection and iniquities, you simply inherited that negative energy. As our sages say, you exchange. You actually lose the positive energy engendered by mitzvahs. Scary stuff, my friends. I gotta tell you, the more I'm learning this, the more I'm thinking to myself, I really need to be more careful about the words I use. But that's what Torah study should do for us. It should make us better people. Studying the panorama of Jewish history should inspire us to live more pridefully and more piously. Hearing about the devastating effects of gossip, of Lashon Hara, should make us resolve not to speak Lashon Hara and not to use the power of our tongue in a negative way. You know, the Medrash on the book of Devarim, not the Medrash Rabbah, but the Sifri, is markedly different than the Sifri on what's called Medrash Halacha, the book of Bamidbar. As I've talked about in a number of my classes, there is Midrashic compilation, which is very much kind of interchanged and interwoven with Halachot, Midrash and Halacha. On the book of Genesis and Exodus, it's called Mechilta. And then these are primarily the teachings from the Yeshiva of Rabbi Akiva. Then we have something called the Safra, which is the Medrash Halacha on the book of Leviticus. And then we have two books, which are often kind of lumped together, called Sifri. Sifri are these Medrash Halacha teachings on the books of Numbers, Bamidbar, and Deuteronomy, Devarim. But they're not really in the similar syntax. The book of Numbers has a heavy emphasis on Halacha, and much less it downplays the agadic portion. Whereas in Deuteronomy, there's a heavier emphasis on the what we call agadic portion. I once heard that this has something to do with the differing schools of Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Both were students of Rabbi Akiva, who have Rabbi Akiva's teachings, but there are different ways in which these teachings were recorded. Some maintain that the Sifri and Dvarim was compiled at a later time, by a disciple of Rav Yochanan, and as such, there are, it's different. But what's really interesting is that historically, we know that the Sifri was missing, the Sifri on Deuteronomy and Devarim was missing many, many teachings attributed to the yeshiva of Rabbi Akiva. And over the last couple of centuries, and even in the last decades, there have been many manuscripts that have emerged. And also, those who have collected from something called Medrash HaGadol, which is a different compilation, and kind of reconstituted a codicil to the Sifri. It's called by the name Medrash Tanoim. That's how it's referred. Medrash Tanoim means the Midrash of the Tanaic sages, the sages of the Mishnah. So in Medrash Tanoim, it says, which is like the Sifri on Dvarim, and I'm quoting to you from chapter 22, verse 19. I don't actually own the book, but the Sefer Yashmiah, Kol Teilosei, cites this Medrash Tanoim. And I'm quoting, Kosha Lashon Hara Lefnei Mi Sha'amar V'Hoya Ha'olam. The notion of slander and gossip is so harsh or difficult upon the Creator, the one who spoke and brought the universe into existence, Shehu Goyrim Galus. It causes our exilic dispersion. And that is the meaning of David HaMelech's lament, Oyoli ki garti meshech shachanti emo lekedar. In other words, my dear friends, this is not just a study of a history of persecution and suffering. This is also a study of our own spiritual culpability. Like, we need to clean up our act. We, Am Yisrael, can do better. And when we create a sense of cohesion and peace from within, it necessarily builds a protective wall from without. How often have I heard wise people say, I'm not worried about the enemies outside. I'm more worried about the enemy from within. The amount of mischaracterization, the amount of demonization, the amount of libel, of lies and deceit that are being hurled against entire groups of Jewish people. It's horrendous. I started using the phrase, I don't judge people by the color of their hat, but rather by the content of their character. It takes people by surprise. Instead of talking about the color of one's skin, which has become part and parcel with a very, very common and politically correct way to look at the world today, all of a sudden the anti-Semitism from within has to be framed in the same fashion. When people tell me, those Haredi Jews, I'm like, which one? Why the generalization? Why the demonization? Why the libel? Why the lies? It's a question we have to ask ourselves, my friend. And this is perhaps our greatest challenge and King David's greatest lament. The problems we create for ourselves and the terrible effect that Galut has upon us. As the Medrash Shir HaShirim tells us, that our sojourns have taken us into Olei Kedar. And Olei Kedar is a euphemism for that which is burned and blackened, like a burned and blackened pot. So often today, we have people of exquisite character, beautiful quality on the inside. The Medrash Shir HaShirim says, you have people, niroyim mibachutz ke'urim u'shchurim, they seem to be blackened. Maybe a euphemism for wearing black hats, I don't know. Smartutin, they seem to be wearing cloth. But mibifnim, on the inside, there are avonim toivis u'margolius. They're packed with precious gems and pearls. Kach Talmidei Chachamim. So sadly, the Medrash laments, oftentimes sages, students of the Torah, appear black to the world around them. But if only people would take the time to look past the black shmata, the black jacket, and to get to know the content of the character of these people, maybe, just maybe, the world would be a different place. The Medrash Tehillim tells us on the very words of Avoh Keder that our experience of Galut has been memushach umemoirat, continuous and rotting or despoiling, in the words of Isaiah in chapter 18, verse 7. And David HaMelech says, Oyo li ki garti meshech, it's one continuum. They took me from Bavel to Madai to Media. Me Media from Media or Persia to Yavan to Greece. Me Yavan, they took me to Edom. It's like a non-ending story. And in every place, sadly, at some point, the persecution began. And we, the Jewish people, are like Ole Kedar, which is also said to refer to Bedouin, what tent-like living. We can't seem to find a place of permanence. Just like the tent people. She'ein lahem lo mokam yeshiva achas. They don't have one place in which they live. Lo amida achat. They don't have one place in which they're stationary. Lo te'a hayom aholekan. Today they pitch their tent there. Lo mochar lahalon or lahalon b'makamachar. The next day, the day after that, to another place. And these are so often the terrible circumstances that have punctuated life for Jewish people as we move from place to place. When the place we called home suddenly didn't recognize us. My dear friends, Kapitel Kufchof, this Shir HaMalot, is indeed, it's the story of Jewish exile, the story of Jewish suffering and persecution, the story of libel and demonization. But it is also, my friends, the story of our own spiritual failings. As Rabbeinu Moshe Alshich puts it, David HaMelech saw firsthand how bad libel, gossip is. This was the experience of David HaMelech, and we talked about it in the previous episode. David HaMelech saw how Doeg slandered him to Shaul, the devastating consequences that slander wrought. In the end, Doeg was dead. The Kohanim of Nov were dead, and Shaul and his children were dead. And it all began with the slander and the gossip from within. I want to finish on a positive note. Not just because we should always be positive, but because it's actually true. It's true that the Torah alludes to the sharpness of words not only when it speaks about gossip, but also when it speaks about Torah. In the Gemara in Masechet Kiddushin, on page 30, side 1, we read, Tanu Rabbanan, our rabbis taught, Vishinantam. When the Torah tells us about the mitzvah of teaching Torah, of studying Torah, it says Vishinantam. Why doesn't it say Vilimadtam? What is Shinun? And the Gemara says that the word Shinun means sharp, swift. Sheyiyu divreiteira michudadim beficha. That the words of Torah should be sharply enunciated, should be crystal clear. You know, like a high definition, a sharp picture. If a person asks you a question about Torah knowledge, al yigamgem, person shouldn't start hemming and hawing, something like this. Emerlei, be able to say Emerlei miyad. This is the meaning of King Solomon's wise observation in the book of Proverbs 7, where he says, Emer lechochma achoisiat. Wisdom should be your sister. There should be a kindred feeling between you and wisdom. Wisdom and you are one, so it should be. And the Gemara finishes off by saying, this is the words we find in Psalm 127, one of the Shir HaMalot, Kichitzim b'yad hagiber, like arrows in the hands of a mighty warrior. Kein b'nei anu urim, such are the years of our youth. In other words, dedicate your youthful years to Torah study. Don't wait till you retire. Ve'oimer chitze giber shenunim. And David HaMelech says earlier, in the beginning of the Shir HaMalot, that words can be sharp as arrows. In other words, the impact of our words doesn't only have to be seen in a negative light. The impact of our words can be seen in a positive light. As I talked about yesterday in detail, that beautiful sicha, rumination from the Rebbe in Lekutei Sichos Chelekei on Parshas Noach, where the Rebbe says that the reason that the Torah talks about Noach's righteousness is because when you speak about somebody else's righteousness, you actually can bring forth their righteousness. Speak positively about others. It's not just about not speaking Lashon Hara. Find ways to encourage and uplift. Not only when you speak face to face, even when you speak of somebody. If you speak in a positive sense, you will make a positive difference. If words of libel, if lies and deceit, if words of gossip can pierce like a sharp arrow, can burn holes months and years later, then imagine how positive, how good positive and good words could be. The power of speech was not meant to be silenced, but rather to be harnessed for goodness. It is true, the Mishnah does say, Siyag l'chachma shtika, a key to wisdom, a gate for wisdom is silence. But at the same time, only silence teaches no one. I'll finish with this little vignette. On a particular Shabbos, the Rebbe had a visitor, a prominent rabbi from Israel, and the Rebbe turned around to him between the talks when the crowd was singing, and the Rebbe asked him to say a few words about some of the pressing issues of the day. And was a wise rabbi, and he knew his place, and he said to the Rebbe, our sages tell us, Mila besela, shtika betray. If a word is worth a dollar, silence is worth two. You know, like the adage, they say, silence is golden. So the Rebbe said to him, but you can only be silent once, and you can say many words. Judaism doesn't say silence is golden, it just says silence is two, and a word is one. And there are times to be silent. But my friends, Hashem gave us the power of articulation, the power of speech, so that we might use it, and use it well. Never underestimate yourself. You are a source of tremendous force and power, and you can be a powerful source for goodness. Use your words. Share words of Torah. Speak words of truth and positivity. And hopefully, in the same way that bad speech can bring bad circumstances, in the same way that gossip brings galut, positive words will bring forth Be'ezras Hashem redemption. The Rebbe once quoted a famous Kabbalistic teaching that the word Mashiach, the anointed one, the phrase used to describe the brilliant future that will soon in Be'ezras Hashem be ours, are the very same Hebrew letters that spell the word Masiach, which means to speak. Speak. positively. Speak powerfully. Speak words of Torah and speak words of goodness. And may that help us put an end to Galut and usher in the wonderful, blessed era of Mashiach. B'mheira ubi amenu. Amen. Thank you so much for joining today.